Our guest now is an award-winning author whose latest work introduces young readers to the world of Māori mythology through a rollicking tale of adventure. Tanya Roxburgh has written and published more than 30 works, including the Banquo Sun trilogy and Bastion Point, 507 Days on Takaparapa, which netted her the 2017 Esther Glenn Award for Children's Literature. She balances her writing career with her day job as a high school English teacher and her studies towards a master's in Te Reo Māori. She's of Ngāti Porou descent, and her latest work, Charlie Tangaroa and the Creature of the Sea, is set in that iwi's rohe at Tolaga Bay. One-legged 13-year-old Charlie is about to learn that his grandfather's tales of warring gods and mythical sea creatures might not be so crazy after all. Tanya Roxburgh is in the Christchurch studio. Kia ora and welcome.
Ata Marie.
You have to give us a taste without giving away the good bits. Introduce us to Charlie and some of the adventures set to go on in this book.
I'm curious. What would you do if you found a mermaid washed up on the beach? Would you call the police? The TV station? Would you poke it in the eye with a stick? That was Robbie's idea, not mine. Before I get to any account of possible eye gouging by my little brother, let me set the scene for you. After all, it's not every week that a Māori boy from the remote East Coast gets to save his town from a family of warring Māori gods.
See,
so that's the opening paragraph.
I'm hooked already. And it's wonderful stuff. And you also, the telling the story, right, is the first thing. You're a writer. You want to engage young readers. But there's wonderful page 218, I think, has a wonderful list of the gods as well. And is this a way of educating and growing knowledge at the same time as not sort of having lists on a blackboard or a set class? It's doing it the way we've always learned, by reading.
Yeah, well, I love story. I inhale story. I watch lots of TV. I watch movies. I read books. And I am a storyteller. So way back in around 2007, 2008, I was teaching my year 12s about, or it might have been my year 10s, about where ideas come from in stories. And I said it often starts with a question. And, you know, one of the things that we do as curious people is and as writers, we ask a question and then we go looking for the answer and then we ask more questions. And on that particular day, I tend to give a very weird examples. I said, so, you know, for example, what would you do if you found a mermaid washed up on the beach? and I put that up on the board. And that night, that kind of rang in my head. And when I woke up in the morning, I could hear Charlie's voice. He was telling me what he would do, and he was telling me about his brother and what his brother would do. And so I immediately got out of bed and I wrote the first two chapters of the book. And there are some students around, or young people, they're not so young anymore, around the country who have had to read and analyse those first two chapters. But something happened. It's like the story disappeared on me, and I couldn't. I didn't know where the story was set. I didn't know who this. I didn't know what was going on. And so, I kind of carried on with my life. And then in 2011, I started my degree in Te Reo Māori at Otago University. And I walked in there thinking I knew some things. And, you know, within about half an hour of being in that first lecture, I realised that I didn't know squat. And it wasn't until I won a scholarship award to have a year off in 2014 that I thought, I'm going to go and do some investigation. And I travelled up to Gisborne. And, you know, in those years, I had begun to learn to speak Te Reo Māori. I had done some history papers on... I did some years ago at Massey in the 80s, but, you know, the world has changed since then. And rather than having a white, wonderful white lecturer, but, you know, it's through a Pākehā lens, now I was being taught by... kaupapa Māori lens, and I thought to myself, I want my students to know about this. And I travelled up to Gisborne, and I was at a cafe, and I'm really sorry that I don't remember. I should have looked where the cafe was, but it's above a wonderful art shop that I bought a piece of art from. And I began to ask myself questions about this story and I was writing in the reo Māori. And this sounds real weird, but anyone who's a writer and anyone who knows me will know that I think, like Hamlet says, you know, there are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in our philosophy. There was a warm wind came and it blew, and it was at that moment that the answers to all the questions that I had about this story, who Charlie was, what he was doing, came to me, and then I just wrote it. And toward the end of 2015, 2016, my agent in New York contacted me to say that Rick Royden had been asked by his publisher to kind of champion Indigenous stories from around the world with a new imprint or a new series called Rick Royden Presents, and would I be interested in... He knew about Charlie and he said, I think this would be quite good. So I originally wrote it for the American audience, showcasing our stories, our way of thinking about the world. It didn't get picked up by Rick Royden's publisher, sadly, but that's okay. And at the end of 2018, not long after I'd sent it to Huia, they rang and said, yeah, we like it. So that's the long, long story of Charlie Tangaroa.
What's interesting is that you had to go on your own journey with your own maritanga, actually, and then on a physical journey to place in order to have the story finished. And I am really interested in more of what you as an adult have... what is the right word for it? You're immersed in it, but you've discovered it. You started... on a hikoi and you kept on going, and what has that done for you as a person and as a writer? Where have you been on these years?
When I was growing up, I always knew two things about my ancestry. I knew that we were Irish and that my ancestor was the cousin of Ned Kelly's dad, so I always knew about the Kelly side.
Another story and, there, by the way.
Yeah, I know. We always knew that we were Māori. Now, of course, in the 1970s, it was all about percentages and stuff like that. So, you know, we knew that we were an eighth Māori and that, you know, my great-grandmother was a full-blooded Māori. But as is often the case of those times, the story of how that happened has been kept secret. I don't have the name of... I have a name, Flavel, that was given to me by my uncle, who has since passed on. So I knew that was it. So I always identified as Māori, but I didn't grow up in Te Ao Māori. We had a very transient life, a very challenging, poor life. I guess I was always trying to find my place. And when I first gave my pepeha... I actually identified the area of Titoki up in Mangakahia as a place that I felt nurtured, even though that is not my rohi, because I swam in the Mangakahia River, I learned to ride horses there, I discovered that I could read, I had wonderful teachers at the area school, I climbed the mountain, Hotu Mountain, and so I felt that that was my place. But as I learned about whakapapa and the importance of tying yourself or connecting yourself, I realised that I had no claim on that. And so I often in my pepeha say that I was sheltered by the forests, nurtured by the river of that area. The thing that I have found really difficult is, so when I grew up north, we knew... It was terrible. It's terrible. And I think a lot of people who grew up in the 70s would recognise this, that, you know, when anything was a bit stink or a bit dumb, it was Maori. Like we go, oh, don't do it the Maori way. And it was a way of kind of putting ourselves down or putting down people. It was just terrible. And I suppose in a way I grew up thinking, I don't want to have that life. I want to have security, and I want to have, I don't want to be poor, and I want to be educated. And so I... You know, I, my bio will talk about this, that I was in foster care for a while, and I'm so incredibly grateful for the two wonderful families who took care of me, and my uncle, whose 90th birthday we just celebrated, who, you know, he believed in me. He's Ngāi Tahu, but, he's just been great in always being there for me. So I was really lucky to have people who did that to support me. But I wanted out of it. I didn't, because in my memory, anything to do with Te Ao Māori was all of the negative stats, the violence and the drinking and the poverty. So I made sure that I changed the way that I spoke. So by the time I got to university, I spoke proper. And I, you know, investigated into literature and language and history. But I always kind of said, I don't need that Māori side. I remember in 1988, and I'm so, so ashamed that I did this, was just as they were bringing in Te Reo Māori and Te Ao Māori into the Teachers College, and I remember some nannies coming in and trying to give us some kind of cultural perspective, and me being really, really arrogant and going, I don't need to learn how to teach by sitting on the mat going, if you're happy and you know it, paki paki. I mean, I can't believe that I had that arrogant way of thinking. I understand now what they were trying to do, but I never applied for any of the scholarships that became available because I thought, I don't need this, I can do it on my own. But there's and many people who don't know where they come from, regardless of their whakapapa, regardless of their ethnicity, often will attest to having a hole or a sense of trying to find where you belong. And I guess that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to know, where do I fit? And because language is so important to me, this was a way I thought that I could do it, that if I could learn to speak Māori, I wouldn't miss out on what was going on the marae. Whenever we went to meetings, I hated not knowing what was going on because I like to know everything, and I didn't like that I couldn't understand. So it was a very selfish way to start off with. But once you start on the journey, well, for me, I couldn't stop because I have found it really, really hard. But if I stop, then everything that I have done up until this point will have been wasted.
I mean, I'm intrigued that you had, probably on that Tiko trip, a visit to Otaku Marae. And if anyone's ever going to have a moment of awakening Pākehā or Māori, it is waking up from that wharemoe and looking out at that view. It's an incredible experience.
Yeah, we took some students there, and I must have been just ready because there was something calling me. And the thing that was really interesting is that the carvings were the design from Ngāti Porou, so they were brought down. I can't remember the story, so I'm not gonna say something. But there's a connection between the Otaku Marae carvings and Ngāti Porou. And I then went up to the kaiako, who was kind of the telling us about this, and I told her my story, and she said, you must start. And then that year, within a month or so, I enrolled at Otago University and began. And, the paper that I've just finished doing through Massey has been looking at the language of the marae, the language of Porporaki, the language of the prophets. And it's just so wonderful to see, if you're a poet or if you love language and you love the shape of language and the way that words have such deep meanings to them, this is the sort of thing that would be thrilling for you to study, and it is for me. And I suppose I'm jumping all over the place. Sorry, Catherine.
That's fine. It's the way we do it here.
It fits in with what my research is about, because my other love, other than my students, is Shakespeare. And I just actually left my one of my Year 10 classes. We're putting on Twelfth Night, and one of the boys has rewritten parts of it, so we're setting it in the 1920s. And I did promise my Year 10 TA that I would do a shout-out to them, because they're right now sitting a writing test while I'm here doing this, and they're a little bit put out that I'm not there with them.
You love your teaching.
I love my class.
It just pours out of every pore. I'm interested in if we move now to the writing, because there's a real, you know, there's 30 published works here.
Yeah.
And I appreciate the work that takes alongside a teaching schedule and the study that you're doing yourself. But who has influenced, who have you read who's Shakespeare and others who have really influenced how you've gone about your own writing?
Oh, that's like asking me which of my two children I love the best. McKenna, I love you, is my eldest, and Brianna, I still love you, even though you don't do my housework for me. Anyway, I wrote stories when I was at primary school. So I think, when I meet up with my aunties and they're delighted to see me and they recount stories of how I was always telling stories. So unlike many writers I know, I'm not quiet, as you can probably guess. And in year 12, my English teacher encouraged me to enter a writing competition and I won it. And I often say, oh, there's probably weren't many people but in the competition. But it made me think, oh, I could do this. And then when I was at university the first time at Massey, my lecturer, Dr. Pat Sandbrook, he took a paper on New Zealand literature. And suddenly I found myself and my voice reflected in the people like Kerry Hume, she came a little bit later, but some of her short stories and the poetry, Robin Hyde, some of the male poets and writers, Maurice G, and I just felt like I came alive in that sense. When I was at Teachers College, I was also interested in drama, and I did a drama course and became teacher in charge of or head of drama for a while at Westlake Girls. And when you're teaching all girls, apart from Shakespeare, we really did struggle at that time to find decent plays that our girls could perform where they weren't having to always necessarily be the guys. And so I wrote a few plays myself, and then somebody heard about it and a publisher got in contact with me. But also I'd read John Marsden's Tomorrow When the War Began, and I love that book. And I knew that he was a teacher, and I arrogantly thought, oh, well, if he can do it, so can I. So I started writing a very bad story, which won't see the light of day. On the one hand, I was doing the teaching, you know, the plays and the textbooks, but also started with the novels and started to use, the people who were really writing and doing a great job of writing at the time that I was writing was David Hill, Fleur Beal, and Mandy Hager. So I read them, and we're a small group of encouraging people, and I loved what they were doing, and I loved that they were capturing the voice of our young people, and that the young people that I was teaching loved what they were writing, and so I wanted to be part of that too. I don't know if that answers your question.
No, it does. So when you write now, because it is some of the hardest writing you will do is for young readers, because they're young and they're not young, and John Marsden's a classical example of this. You can't You can't write for them like they are children. You have to write to the inner complexities and challenges and fears and dreams that are as potent and as keenly felt as any adult. And so what are the particular things you've learned about writing for younger readers? And of differing ages between a primary school kid and the kids that you're teaching English. What wisdom have you learned from being around them and from writing for them?
That's a really good question, Catherine. I think all teachers would know it's not my job to tell kids how to think as a writer. I feel my job is to give voice to the characters who come to me to tell their stories and to be... that little phrase, it doesn't have to be real, but it has to be true. And I suppose, you know, you just like I remember going through a stage of reading all of Jane Austen's work, and I could feel my writing being influenced by the voice in that. I think I am influenced by what I see in my classrooms. But what I will say is people who are not teachers completely underestimate the intelligence and the passion and the interest and curiosity of young people. You know, the fact that last year, this year's year 10s, I had them last year's year 9, put on A Midsummer Night's Dream on their own. We put on the full production. Just a couple of days ago, I had a student from Kelston Girls from many years ago contact me with a photo of when we did A Midsummer Night's Dream, and they were a year 10 or year 9 or year 10. The thing is that the kids are able to be much more than what they get given credit for. And they have great bullshit detectors as well. Like, sorry, I don't know if I can say that on
fine.
Radio.
There's no other way of putting it.
No, but they can sniff it out. And I suppose the thing is that maybe when I first started writing, I thought, oh, I need to tell teenagers not to give up, you know, that it's good to da, da, da. I don't do that anymore. I go, what is it that my character wants? Why can't they get it? What is it that they're going to learn at the end of this, and how are they going to get there? And let's have a story, and let me, the writer, be as mean as possible and make it really, really hard for them. So I suppose that's the process for me, how it works for me. And the other thing is, like, I heard somebody say about young readers, oh, they don't read big books. And that makes me really cross. You know, like, you know, every... Monday morning, I have my year 9 writing class, and there's always two kids sitting beside outside my classroom waiting for me to open the door with huge books. They're reading huge books. So kids who read, read. And it doesn't matter the size of it or what's in it. It's short or long or whatever. People love good story, and they like a variety of stories. So there's enough room, I think, for all sorts of stories, and diminishing what students can do irritates me.
Well, there's a real variety in your own, from Bastion Point to Banco Sun trilogy, which is completely different again, and now this new kind of exciting adventure for Charlie Tangaroa. And I mean, is it literally as you describe it, an idea will come? I mean, they're different genre in many ways, actually. Is there an underlying passion in you that will lend you to say, actually, I really want to pursue this particular project because I want it to have an impact? Is there an element of that as well?
Like for the Banquo Sun trilogy, I mean, I was really, really lucky. I know a lot of writers have beta readers. Well, my beta readers are my students. I mean, you get to be in my class and you're going to be exposed to some of my writing. And so for the first chapter of Charlie Tangaroa, I gave to my year 12 writing class a couple of years ago, and I said, go at it with the knives, and boy did they. Whew. You know, so I'm lucky in that sense that, well, maybe not lucky. I try to develop a culture within my classroom that if I am going to critique your work, I will invite you to kindly critique mine. And with the trilogy, there is a story out there where I had the babes, the group of students who are all in their late 20s now, who were amazing. They were great readers, and they took my story and they told me when I got rogue notes and when it was flat and when it was wrong and when it didn't work. And so I was really lucky in that sense, to be able to give the manuscript to these young people, 14-year-olds, 15-year-olds, who read and commented and contributed. And I think, like with Charlie Tangaroa, which I found quite interesting, and again, this comes back to almost like the spiritual nature of writing, I didn't know that this was going to be a story that at its heart would have environment. I'm not, like, I'm so, you know, supportive of, slowing down climate change and fixing our environment, and I'm a tidy Kiwi and all that sort of thing, but I'm not an activist when it comes to the climate, to the environment, and yet Charlie is. Like, he so is. And I didn't see that coming when I was writing the story, that's how it would end up. And that's cool. That was great, because it meant I had to go and do some reading around some certain things so that it's right. But there is another story. I'm writing another book in the Charlie Tangaroa series, and it's called Charlie Tangaroa and the God of War. And the thing that my husband always laughs about is that often what I write comes true. So and so sadly for Tolaga Bay, the slash that ended up on the beach, I wrote that last year in the second book, and I was like, oh, this is terrible. But anyway, it's quite topical.
What Huia, of course, are doing amazing work.
Yes,
and are you seeing, and have you seen over your years as a teacher, a much broader New Zealand voice and the accessibility of it? Or is it still a really big road to be climbed?
I think in the 5 years that I... Say, for example, so I teach at Lincoln High School, and it's a great school. It's a very typical New Zealand high school set rural. It actually reminds me of a school I used to teach at that I loved, Orewa. So it's up in that kind of the fringes of the city. It's got quite a lot of country kids who come in, and we have one of the highest number of buses. And when I started, I was all, you know, just finished my degree. I was all really passionate at kind of making sure that te ao and te reo Māori was at the forefront of my teaching, even though I teach English. I wanted to open up the world of the eyes of students who hadn't had an opportunity, although many, many students do get a little taster in primary school, which is great. And at the end of the year, I did a survey because I was thinking, oh, I want to know, you know, how did I do? How did they feel about me, you know, often explaining the grammar or bringing in whakatauki or just some ideas or some of the stories that we chose? And I was devastated with the results because 85% of the students, so I surveyed six classes from year 9 to year 12, said that were negative, either disinterested or please can you not? And yet in that time, there's been a huge shift. And I think a lot of it is to do with people on radio, the things that, like when I started in 2016, people were not on national radio speaking te reo Māori in the way that we are now. It's fantastic. On television, we've got Stacey and Scotty Morrison, we've got books, we've got Hemi Kelly, we've got people, you know, really, really celebrating and having a go. And our school is one of those schools that it's not lip service, it's people are really serious. We have a lot of teachers, Pākehā and Māori, who are learning te reo Māori, and the kids see that. And last year I did the survey again and it was flipped. There was 15% of students who were not happy that there was te reo Māori or Māori texts in the English lesson. And I just think that that's incredible, and that's the shift that I've seen. And I think when it comes to the English teachers that I connect with, the desire is there as well. The heart's desire is there to stand confidently in Aotearoa and say, this is unique. We are unique. We have this language as a way of informing our way of thinking. It seeps into our English, I suppose, similar to maybe how French does in Canada. I don't know that very well. We're any bilingual nations, and I'm seeing it. And the will is there from English teachers to find texts that more accurately represent the children in front of them, whether that's Pacifica or Asian or Māori. My co-author, Catherine Fitzgerald, and I have just released a third book in a series of books for senior English for Level 3 NCA, and we selected only New Zealand writers. We had so many to choose from, but we wanted all of the texts to be a celebration of our world, and in the hope that kids, at least kids could see themselves in at least one of the texts.
And cracking good reads, of course, are at the heart of it too. Thank you, Tanya. Better get back and rescue that test class. Thank you very much for your time this morning. Tanya Roxburgh, and the latest book is Charlie Tangaroa and the Creature from the Sea. Illustrations are by Phoebe Morris. The publisher is Huia.